From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
In a letter from Guantanamo, a detainee says he was beaten, tortured, and witnessed the deaths of two other detainees.
Today, we take a look at the case of Mozan Beg with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu makes his stage debut in New York in a new play called Guantanamo, Honor Bound to Defend Freedom, based on the transcripts of those detained at Guantanamo and their loved ones on the outside. We'll speak with the Nobel Peace Prize winner about President Bush, Iraq, and Guantanamo.
Isn't it time there was the same sense of outrage that people had about apartheid?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has admitted he has not seen any hard evidence that links Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda. At an event hosted by the Council on Foreign Relations, Rumsfeld was asked by an audience member about what links exist.
I have seen the answer to that question migrate in the intelligence community over a period of a year in the most amazing way. Second, there are differences in the intelligence community as to what the relationship was. To my knowledge, I have not seen any strong, hard evidence that links the two.
Donald Rumsfeld speaking Monday, 2 years ago in the lead-up to the Iraq invasion, Rumsfeld claimed the U.S. had credible information that al-Qaeda leaders had sought contacts in Iraq who could help them acquire weapons of mass destruction. He also said in 2002, quote, solid evidence showed there were senior al-Qaeda members in Iraq. The former head of the U.S. occupation in Iraq, Paul Bremer, charged yesterday the U.S. failed to have enough troops in Baghdad following the fall of Baghdad. He suggested the mass uncontrolled looting helped pave the way for resistance against the U.S. presence. Bremer said, quote, we paid a big price for not stopping it because it established an atmosphere of lawlessness. We never had enough troops on the ground. A leading Kuwaiti newspaper is reporting that a number of Iraqi resistance groups are planning on uniting under a single umbrella to oppose the U.S. presence in Iraq. The paper reports the resistance group will command a total of 7,000 fighters across Iraq. In addition, the resistance groups are threatening to take up arms against suspected al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi unless he stops carrying out attacks against Shiite Iraqis. A source for the New Unity Group said, quote, if Zarqawi does not abandon his plans to instigate a sectarian rift, the groups will force him to do so, even if that requires taking up arms against him. The group's stance on Zarqawi casts new doubts on the Bush administration's claim that Zarqawi is leading the resistance. A new report by Newsday has found Zarqawi has far less power than portrayed by the U.S. and the media. The paper estimates his group has just 100 members inside Iraq. A new Arab intelligence assessment cited by Newsday determined Zarqawi does not have the support to carry out all the attacks he takes credits for. Meanwhile, President Bush said of the Iraqi resistance, quote, we're dealing with an enemy that has no conscience. These people are brutal. They're the exact opposite of Americans, he said. Four U.S. soldiers were charged with murder Monday for killing an Iraqi general who suffocated during an interrogation. The Denver Post has reported the soldiers put a sleeping bag over the man's head and rolled him onto his stomach. The medical examiner found the general had died of asphyxiation from chest compression and from being smothered. The soldiers could face life in prison for the murder. Governmental officials in Poland said yesterday they expect to pull their troops out of Iraq by the end of 2005. Poland's the fourth largest troop contributor to the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq. The announcement comes as opposition to the Polish presence increases. One recent poll showed 70% of Poles oppose the presence of Polish troops in Iraq. One opposition party, the Polish Peasants Party, has launched a petition calling for an immediate pullout. Pentagon statistics show September was the second deadliest month of the year for U.S. forces in Iraq. 80 soldiers died during the month, up from 65 in August. At the United Nations, Arab nations called on the Security Council to adopt a resolution condemning Israel for its ongoing attack on Gaza. Algeria's U.N. ambassador said, quote, "The Palestinian people are exposed to a virtual war of extermination. The unfettered use of brutal force is terrifying," he said. The U.S. indicated it would veto any anti-Israel resolution. Agence France-Presse reports U.S. Ambassador John Danforth accused the United Nations of acting, quote, as the adversary of Israel and the cheerleader of the Palestinians. A new report by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has found that 41% of the fatalities in Gaza over the last week have been civilians. The group estimates Israeli forces have killed 75 Palestinians, 31 of whom were civilian. Among the dead, 19 Palestinian children, 17 or under. The group says 50,000 Palestinians are living under complete siege without water and electricity and little food. B'Tselem also reports Israeli forces have demolished 55 homes in the Jabalia refugee camp and other 50 additional houses have been severely damaged. B'Tselem also condemned Palestinian militants for continuing to carry out missile attacks against Israel, which they said constitutes a war crime. But the group said in a statement, quote, "The grief for the death of the Israeli civilians cannot justify such extensive harm to Palestinian civilians uninvolved in the hostilities." Illinois and Wisconsin Monday launched the nation's first state-sponsored program to help residents buy cheaper prescriptions from other countries despite a federal ban on such programs. The Food and Drug Administration has issued a complaint to the states, but news reports indicate the FDA does not intend to shut the program down. State officials estimate residents in Illinois and Wisconsin will now be able to purchase scores of drugs up to 50% off the U.S. retail price. The New York Civil Liberties Union is accusing the New York Police Department of illegally fingerprinting the majority of people arrested during the Republican National Convention. Of the more than 1,800 people arrested during the mass arrests, most were charged with minor violations such as disorderly conduct and parading without a permit. The Council on American-Islamic Relations is reporting anti-Islamic sentiment in the country is deeper than the group had previously understood. A new study commissioned by the group shows one in four Americans holds a negative stereotype of Muslims, and almost one-third respond with a negative image when they hear the word Muslim. More than a quarter of people polled felt Muslims value life less than other people and that Muslims teach their children to hate non-believers. The group conducted the poll over the summer after it released its annual civil rights report that determined harassment, violence, and discrimination against American Muslims has increased by 70% since 2002. Alice Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration's arguing the president can detain enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay as long as necessary to protect national security and that they have no constitutional rights to hear charges against them. Facing a deadline to give a federal judge some answers, about 60 of the so-called enemy combatants held at the U.S. Navy base in Cuba, the government filed a 96-page response detailing the reasons it believes it doesn't need to explain why they were detained or how long they may be imprisoned. More than 550 people have been held at Guantanamo without charge or trial for more than 2 years. Government lawyers wrote the detentions are a, quote, integral and inexorable part of the commander-in-chief's power to defend the nation and vanquish the enemy. But the deputy commander of the joint task force that controls Guantanamo thinks otherwise. Brigadier General Martin Lucenti told the Financial Times, quote, most of the detainees weren't fighting, they were running. Even if somebody has been found to be an enemy combatant, many of them will be released because they will be of low intelligence value and low threat status, he said. Either way, the Pentagon's planning to construct a permanent prison facility at Guantanamo known as Camp 6. Some see it as a move to fortify the makeshift prison and ultimately place all remaining detainees in permanent structures. One of those remaining detainees is British citizen Mozam Beg. He was detained in Pakistan in 2001 and has been imprisoned without charge or trial at Guantanamo after being transferred there from a base in Afghanistan. Since arriving in Guantanamo, Beg has had no contact with fellow prisoners and has been kept in solitary confinement for over 600 days. The government has declassified a letter that Mozam Beg wrote on Friday. He says he was tortured and abused during detention and that he witnessed U.S. soldiers partially kill two men in Afghanistan. In the uncensored letter, Beg protested his innocence of any crime and demanded to know the reason for his detention. He said he was denied natural light and fresh food, had been held in solitary confinement, and was forced to sign an initial documents presented to him by U.S. officials. He also said he was physically abused, stripped, and paraded in front of cameras held by U.S. personnel. The letter came past the usual U.S. military censors, but it was the first communication from Mozam Beg that was entirely unclassified. It was dated July 12, 2004, and addressed to the military command at Guantanamo Bay. In it, Beg requests it be copied to his lawyers and U.S. and British authorities. We're joined now by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He is author of the book Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
How significant is this letter?
Well, it's the first letter we've gotten that's uncensored, that charges torture, that he saw deaths. So it's very significant because you can say what's happening to Mozam Beg or what happened to him, the isolation, the torture, the beatings, is very likely happening to many, many others in Guantanamo. So it's extremely significant. The reason it got out is not chance. It was because Mozam Beg is the first person who has actually had a lawyer go down to see him. A lawyer, we got a court order allowing a lawyer, he's since the Supreme Court case, the first one, the only one so far, shortly before she went to Guantanamo, she got this letter. So they obviously realized, and as time goes on, as we get lawyer by lawyer down there, I think we will get more and more stories like Mozam Beg's.
I wanted to go back to last April when we were joined in the studio by Mozam Beg's father, Asmat Beg. He talked about his son's imprisonment.
He was captured from Islamabad, which is the capital of Pakistan, where he's staying with his wife and children, very small children, starting from the age of one, two, and four or five. He had three children at that time.
And where was he taken?
Well,
When was this?
Well, that's about 2 years now, so over 2 years now. He was taken from his house in front of his daughter and his wife, and two American soldiers, assisted by two Pakistan soldiers, pulled him out, bundled him up, and put it into the trunk of the car and took away. And he rang me up from the trunk of the car, possibly he had mobile, and he told me in the middle of the night here in England that, Daddy, I have been arrested. I said, what for? It was very whispering sort of noise. I couldn't believe. He said, I have been arrested, Daddy. I said, why? He said, I don't know. And they are taking me somewhere which I do not know. Please take care of my wife and children who are at so-and-so address in Islamabad.
Where were you?
I was in England. I was in England. I was half asleep.
And so he was taken to Guantanamo. Have you had...
No, they didn't take him straight away to Guantanamo. They took him to Afghanistan and kept in a province called Kandahar for a month or so. And then they transferred him to another place in Afghanistan, which is known as Bagram Air Base, where he was badly treated, very badly treated.
How do you know?
Because I received letters. Through Red Cross. Red Cross people came down to me, delivered the letters, and they were having correspondence with him through Red Cross all the time. And then when a little bit of noise raised in the UK, they transferred him to Guantanamo Bay. He was badly treated. He was deprived of proper food. He was deprived of natural light, sun, moon, or anything. He said that I haven't seen sun, moon, or sky for the last whole 1 year except for 2 minutes. I'm being treated like an animal. They pull me and push me into cages. And that's how I'm here now. I get, at times, I don't get food. And my clothes are torn. They don't care. And I don't know whom to go to.
Have you spoken to him?
Never.
He writes you letters?
He wrote his letters when he was in Kandahar, in Bagram, and he also wrote letters from Guantanamo Bay when he was transferred.
Asmat Beg, he is the father of Mozan Beg, lives in Britain, has been campaigning to have his son released from Guantanamo. Michael Ratner, yesterday, the U.S. government filed a brief. Can you talk about the administration arguing the president can detain what he calls enemy combatants as long as necessary?
It's remarkable. You know, the Center for Constitutional Rights won this case June 28th of this year. The Supreme Court said clearly they have to justify detentions on an individual basis, and people have constitutional rights in Guantanamo. They are treating, the government is treating, the Supreme Court decision essentially as a suggestion. They're saying we can ignore it. It's incredible. I mean, it's real lawlessness at the most basic level. And everything we've gotten in these cases, whether it's the letter that was released from Mozan Beg or any detainee out, has just been an uphill battle with the government inch by inch. But I can tell you, I think we're going to eventually close that camp.
Even though they're talking about setting up a new one called Camp 6.
You know, it's illegality after illegality. They are not living in a lawless zone any longer since the Supreme Court decision. It may take us time. It may take us pushes by other governments, and so far I hope they do that in Britain and other places, to eventually say, this is something from another generation. This will be looked like one day like we now look at the Japanese concentration camps during the Second World War that were in the United States.
Now, some of the people have been released. How many?
Well, I think a couple of hundred have been released, but a bunch were released before we won in the Supreme Court as a way of trying to influence the Supreme Court. A number have been released after that. Once again, the government is doing it slowly because I think they don't want the total embarrassment of understanding they are running a camp that's completely irrelevant to the war on terror.
Michael Ratner is author of Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. We're going to go to break. Then when we come back, there is a new play in New York that opened in London. It is called Guantanamo, Honor Bound to Defend Freedom, based on the actual transcripts of prisoners' letters from Guantanamo, as well as their loved ones outside. We are going to hear a clip of the actor playing Mozan Beg reading what he's had to say. And then we go to Bishop Tutu, who performed in this play this weekend. I had a chance to interview him afterwards. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on more than 275 radio and television stations in the country, pioneering the largest public media collaboration in the United States on Pacifica stations, on NPR stations, public access TV, on PBS, and on both satellite networks, Dish Networks Channel 375, Link TV, Dish Networks Channel 9415, which is Free Speech TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375, Link TV. Michael Ratner, our guest. He's president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, author of the book Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. Why do we know so much about Moazzam Begg in particular?
Well, two reasons. One is his father has been very public and was actually in touch with him at the moment he was arrested in Pakistan. Moazzam Begg was put into the boot of a car or the trunk of a car, and he had his cell phone with him, and he was able to call his father from the cell phone and tell him what happened. Plus, his wife and his child witnessed American and Pakistani agents coming into his house in Pakistan and taking him away. Then we've gotten a couple of letters. We got one early letter that Osmet Begg described, where he said he'd been in Bagram for 11 months and could only see the sun and the stars in this famous, infamous underground facility in Bagram, where a lot of bad torture has apparently gone on. Plus, now we have this newest letter from him. But again, we have the newest letter only because his lawyer, Gita Gutierrez, was recently in Guantanamo. And because of that, she was the first person there. Because of that, the government, I think, felt forced to have to release this letter to her.
And what is he charged with?
Well, Amy, he's charged with nothing, zero. There has never been a charge against him. Despite that, when he got to Guantanamo, he was put into a special isolation camp called Camp Echo. And presumably, and it's a guess, but he may have been put there because he actually witnessed, according to this last letter, as he says, partially witnessed the deaths of two people in Afghanistan. He may be being kept there because they don't want him telling that story. And it's only, as I said, only because we are finally opening up Guantanamo, finally, that we're getting any information like this.
Well, this weekend I went over to the Culture Project at 45 Bleecker in New York City, and it is now showing a new play that comes from London called Guantanamo. The script is based on the spoken and written testimony of Guantanamo detainees, family members, lawyers, public officials. The play... one of the people in the play is an actor that plays Moazzam Begg. This is an excerpt from Guantanamo, Honor Bound to Defend Freedom.
Assalamu alaikum. I have received your message and I'm glad that all is well with you and the family. It is nearing a complete year since I have been in custody, and I believe now that there has been a gross violation of my human rights, particularly to that right of freedom and innocence until proven guilty. After all this time, I still don't know what crime I am supposed to have committed, for which not only I, but my wife and children should continually suffer for as a result. I am in a state of desperation and beginning to lose the fight against depression and hopelessness. Whilst I do not at all complain about my personal treatment, conditions are such that I have not seen the sun, sky, moon, etc. for nearly a year, since it has been the same for every day for all the time I have been here. My situation here is unique in many ways, for good and bad, but mostly bad. I believe it is wrong for me to have been kept like this, and I have served more than enough time for whatever it is that has been perceived about me, yet I still see no end in sight, and present to. I hate so much to place this burden upon you, but do so as a last resort to alleviate this injustice. Please, remember me in your prayers, your son, Mozan.
Mozan Beg is played by Asif Manvi in the new off-Broadway play called Guantanamo, Honor Bound to Defend Freedom. This weekend, Archbishop Desmond Tutu made his debut in the play as a British judge, Lord Justice Stein, who questioned the legal justification for the detention regime. Once a leading campaigner against apartheid, Bishop Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, now a vocal critic of Guantanamo. After the play, we had a public conversation for the audience at the Culture Project. I began by asking Archbishop Desmond Tutu what his response is to what's happening at Guantanamo.
I thought I knew what was taking place there, and I was quite shocked when I sat through the play yesterday, just how devastated I was. I was particularly so because I had such an awful sense of deja vu. For someone coming from South Africa, you said, but I mean, that's exactly what they were doing for exactly the same reasons that they gave. I mean, you said, why do you detain people without trial? Why do you ban people as you're doing? And the response from the South African government was security of the state. And anyone who questioned it would then be regarded, especially if you were white, as being unpatriotic. And I just want to say to you, is this something that you want done in your name? Isn't it time there was the same sense of outrage that people had about apartheid, which people should have had about the Holocaust? And what would happen if it was Americans held by some other country under these conditions? The point is, God has actually got no one. The God we worship is strange. They say this God is omnipotent, but God is also very weak. There's not a great deal that God seems to be able to do without you.
During your years in South Africa, before the end of apartheid, you were a deep advocate of nonviolence, yet you saw so many detained, so many killed. What do you feel, and what did you feel then? How did you make it through those days? What did you advocate? how did you stick to your principles of nonviolence?
One of the wonderful things, actually, is when I've got to speak as a Christian, is belonging to the church and knowing that you belong to this extraordinary body. When things were really rough, it's wonderful to recall for me now, but I sometimes got, when the South African government had taken away my passport, I got passports of love from Sunday school kids here in New York. And I plastered them on the walls of my office that although I couldn't travel, hey, here were all of these wonderful people all over the world. And I had I met a nun in New York at that particular time, and I asked her, can you just tell me a little bit about your life? How do you... And she said, well, I am a solitary. I live in the woods in California. I pray for you. My day starts at 2 a.m. And I said, hey, man, I'm being prayed for at 2 a.m. in the woods in California. What chance does the apartheid government stand? So, one was being upheld. And you know, when frequently you say to people, the victory that we won against apartheid, a spectacular victory, that would not have happened without the support of the international community, without the support of people like yourselves, without the support of those who were students at the time, who might have been crazies, but they were fantastic in their commitment. And in this country, actually, they showed that you could in fact change the moral climate. Because at the time the Reagan administration was totally opposed to sanctions. And students, but not just students, the many, many people who were prepared to be arrested on our behalf, who demonstrated on our behalf, who boycotted on our behalf, well, they changed the moral climate to such an extent that Congress passed the anti-apartheid legislation and they even managed a veto override, which was fantastic. And so I always say I was a leader by default because our real leaders were either in jail or in exile. And sometimes when people say, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize, I say, well, actually, you know, it was that they thought maybe it was time it was given to a black. And, he has an easy surname. Imagine if I'd had a surname like Bukakauli. You know?
Archbishop Tutu, how do you feel? How do you feel about...
You can pronounce that.
How do you feel about the invasion and occupation of Iraq?
It was fantastic seeing the many, many people who came out in opposition. It was fantastic. You know, sometimes when you say, Americans, or people nowadays don't care. It's not true. Millions turned out. Millions said, no, give peace a chance. And I said, as so many others, I wasn't the only one. The Pope said so too. The Archbishop of Canterbury said so. The Dalai Lama said so. That this war, if it was to be a justifiable war in terms of the just war theory, would have to be one that was declared by a legitimate authority. And the administration here was aware of that. That's why they went to the UN. There's no point in going to the UN if you had already decided. They probably, of course, had decided. But, I mean, there was no point unless they believed or they realized, I mean, that in order for it to be legitimate and therefore justifiable, the only authority would have to be the UN. And when they didn't get what they wanted from the UN, they did what they did. We said then, and we keep saying so, not just that it was illegal, it was immoral. And the consequences of it just now, I mean, you've really got to be blind to say, well, yeah, it's okay, we removed Saddam Hussein. Why didn't you say that was the reason for going? Because the world would have said, no. That isn't a reason that will be allowable for you to declare the war. And I'm sad that we seem so inured now. They tell you 100 people have been killed. And the United States and its allies are doing that. And they say, no, we targeted that house because our intelligence said so. Intelligence. The same intelligence that said there were weapons of mass destruction. Please. That's been done in your name. That mothers and children have been killed. And when you say, what about the civilian casualties? Say, sorry. Our intention was to target insurgents. And most of us, I think, just shrug our shoulders. But you see, you experienced a little bit on September the 11th. The kind of thing that is meted out on a regular basis. And they're not casualties. Collateral damage, I tell you. How do you feel if somebody says the people who died in the World Trade Center and in Washington D.C. collateral damage? Say that to someone who lost a wife. Say it to someone who lost a child. Someone who lost a friend. Collateral damage. It's an obscenity. It's an obscenity. It's in order to say, no, They don't have faces. They don't have names. This is someone's mother, someone's wife, someone's child. Not statistics. And you know what? God is weeping. God is weeping. God is weeping because one of the incredible things, Amen, is that Saddam Hussein, Bin Laden, George Bush, all God's children. And God says, whatever got into me to create that lot? and then God sees some of you, all of you who care. And God then begins to smile through the tears. Please, God wants peace. God wants prosperity for everyone. And you know what? I have yet to meet people more generous than Americans. And I'm not being smarmy. I have experienced it, my family have experienced it on a personal level. Why don't you want to export your generosity, your compassion, and not bombs?
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, we'll come back to him in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, as we return now to the former South African Archbishop, Desmond Tutu.
What do you think George Bush should have done after September 11th, and what do you think he should do now?
You know what? One of the things that annoyed us most when we were struggling against apartheid was have someone arrive from another country and pontificate about how we ought to solve our problems. But having said so, no. It would actually be wonderful one day if politicians found it in themselves to say, I pooped. It would be such a wonderful thing. I've suggested it to I suggested it to Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush that, look, you're not infallible. You're human. You can make mistakes. You make mistakes. We all do.
It would have been such an incredible element into the situation. We've seen it at home in South Africa, in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, when people who have perpetrated some of the most ghastly atrocities say sorry. It has an incredible capacity to change the dynamics of a situation. Well, those of us who are married know just how difficult it is. It is the most difficult set of words to say in any language. I find it difficult to say it in the privacy of our bedroom, to say, sorry, darling, I'm sorry. But what it can accomplish, to say sorry, it pours balm. We've seen it do that. A country that should have gone up in flames, South Africa, was saved by the fact that people were ready to forgive and people were ready to say sorry. That would be the first step.
Do you think George Bush would win if he said, I'm sorry?
I think one has got to ask Americans, what is it that you want to be known for? You want to be known for a country who, having become the superpower, realized actually that in this moral universe, power is for service. That you were going to use your power to try to transform the world into what God wants it to be, where there is gentleness and laughter and compassion and caring. You've got the capacity to help eradicate poverty and disease and ignorance. You have got that capacity. Do you want for people to say, yeah, that's the kind of country we would like to live in? Or do you want, as now, people who were deeply sympathetic to Americans after September the 11th, well, in the popularity stakes, America is not number one. And yet you can be. But it is up to you. It really is up to you. God has given you remarkable prosperity and all of the goodies. But if you don't realize that as long as there are conditions that make people desperate in other parts of the world, you are not going to be able to enjoy your prosperity. Ultimately, that it is in your best interests to be generous. It's not being altruistic. It's not being altruistic. It's how God operates, actually. And God has taken a huge risk on all of us
another moment, God has taken a risk and says, "Yeah, I'm letting you have all of these my goodies, and I hope you realize I have given them to you so that you help me to make this world more humane." And it's up to you.
Do you think that Osama bin Laden should be charged with war crimes? And do you think that George Bush should be charged with war crimes?
Who would be the tribunal?
An international criminal court.
Yes. Well, of course, you said you don't. You're not signing on to it. It's actually quite incredible that it is possible for here to, I mean, you know, you say, no, we want to belong to the international community. Ah, how about Kyoto? What? That's for everybody else, not for me. Go jump in the lake. How about the International Criminal Court? Everybody says, yeah, if we are serious about human rights and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, this is something that we should have. Virtually everybody signs on to it. And you say to the world, go jump in the lake. And then there is this thing called terrorism. And you discover that even the most powerful nation in the world can't go it alone. You need others. But you need others for everything, really. In our part of the world, we have something called Ubuntu, the essence of being human. And we say a person is a person through other persons. I can't be human in isolation. I need you to be all you can be so that I can become me and all that I can be. That we are made for family. And if we're made for family, then, yeah. The rule of law is one of the things that says you want to make sure, especially, that the powerful don't go around throwing their weight about. I'm afraid the impression that the rest of the world has, especially the so-called third world, is that there's actually just one model of power. Power that globus. Power that says, me, I'm above the law. And then we're surprised at all the tin despots and dictators we get around who see, that is what you do when you have power. That is what you do. Now, again, speaking as a Christian, you might have thought that Jesus was actually a bit stupid when Jesus said, if you are the one who wants to be first, you must be as the last. If you want really to be a leader, you must be prepared to serve. And you think, Anna, that's crazy. But why do we revere someone like Mother Teresa? She's not, I mean, she's many things, but one of those is certainly not macho. It is, why? Because she's good, because she's generous, because she's been someone who was a spendthrift on behalf of others. The Dalai Lama. I mean, one of the world's outstanding. I've not met anyone more holy, more serene. But this is a guy who's been away from his country as a refugee and exile. Sense of fun. I mean, he bubbles over with joy. And I say to him, I mean, that he's also even mischievous. He's like a schoolboy. But he's wonderful to behold. And Nelson Mandela. The world reveres those people. Not because they've got power of the kind where you can clobber. Power to serve. And how about helping God bring about the kind of world that all of us actually long for? Because you know, did you know, you are made for goodness. You are made for love. You are made for caring. You are made for sharing, for gentleness. And God says, aren't they neat? Aren't they something? Aren't they cool? Because again, God has no one, absolutely no one except you. And God says, yeah, I'm still going to wager on them. And in that kind of world, yeah, we say there are rules that have to apply and apply universally.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, thank you very much. Thank you.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the former Archbishop of South Africa, speaking after the play Guantanamo, that is now in New York. Archbishop Desmond Tutu is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Daniel Cashin. Our website is democracynow.org. Tomorrow, October 6th, I'll be at the Jean Rimsky Theater in Port Washington, New York. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.